Welcome to NGA Notable Lectures, a podcast offering a deeper understanding of all things artistic. Bronislava Nijinska, the sister of famed ballet dancer and choreographer Vaslav Nijinsky, was a pioneer of the modern tradition of ballet. In spring 2013, Lynn Garofalo was awarded a Guggenheim Fellowship to support her research on Nijinska. In this lecture recorded on July 7, 2013, at the National Gallery of Art, Garofalo shares her latest research and thoughts on how Nijinska's life and work not only illuminated modern ballet history, but 20th century culture as a whole. In 1913, Nijinska was evicted from her brother's production, The Rite of Spring, for getting married, an act that he perceived as a betrayal. Afterward, although she was no longer dancing for her brother, Nijinska still played a crucial role in the dissemination of modernism. The longevity of her career eclipsed that of her brother's, and her work influenced numerous dancers and choreographers. Held in conjunction with the exhibition Diaghilev and the Ballet Russe, 1909-1929, When Art Danced with Music, on view at the gallery from May 12 to October 6, 2013, this lecture was supported in loving memory of Shirley Cass Stevens.
In spring 1913, as rehearsals for The Rite of Spring moved slowly forward, see, there is The Rite of Spring, Vaslav Nijinsky, the choreographer, evicted Bronislava Nijinska, his sister, and the ballet's chosen maiden from the cast. She had betrayed him, first by getting married, then by getting pregnant. Yet she would continue to dance throughout the company's Paris and London seasons, often in two ballets an evening, but not in her brother's new works. In Je and The Rite of Spring, she would remain only a shadowy presence, haunting the movement he had created for her and on her, but rendered invisible by the dancer who assumed her role. The artistic twinship that had given birth to Afternoon of a Faun the year before was sundered by her brother's rage at the workings of her female body. In his most important work, she was there and not there, present and absent, a situation that seems in retrospect to sum up her own uncertain status with respect to ballet history. The ambiguous position of her works in the ballet canon, and the willful unremembering that often masks her passage through the ballet past. Yet Bronislava Nijinska was the premier female ballet choreographer of the first half of the 20th century and a pioneer of the modern tradition in ballet. Overshadowed in life and work and legend by her brother, she nevertheless had a far longer and more productive career. She was an architect of 20th century neoclassicism who experienced the transformative power of the Russian Revolution and created her greatest work under the influence of its avant-garde. She brought a woman's sensibility to her choreography, and many of her works rested upon the probing of gender boundaries and a mistrust of conventional gender roles. A key figure of Russia abroad, she contributed to the many diasporic or emigre companies, including her own short-lived ensembles, that dotted the ballet landscape of the interwar years, and through her career as a freelance choreographer, played a crucial role in the dissemination of modernism. She choreographed the original versions of several modernist scores, introducing them to the ballet repertory, and in her multiple roles as teacher, choreographer, and ballet mistress, influenced the careers of numerous dancers and choreographers. Finally, she was an articulate writer, the author of an acclaimed volume of memoirs, in addition to a major treatise on movement. Her life illuminates not only the modern history of ballet, but also 20th century culture more generally. So, born in Minsk, Russia, on 27 December 1890, old style, Bronislava Nijinska, or Bronislava Fominichna Nijinska, was the daughter of itinerant Polish dancers and sister of the ballet wunderkind Vaslav Nijinsky. Nijinska was born to dance. She received her earliest training from her parents, Thomas in Polish, Foma in Russian, Nijinsky, and Eleonora Bereda, and made her debut in a sailor dance just before her fourth birthday. In 1900, after studying for several months with the great Italian pedagogue Enrico Cecchetti, she entered St. Petersburg's Imperial Ballet School, graduating in 1907 into the Corps de Ballet of the Mariinsky Theater. Here, despite the occasional solo, she found little to stimulate her. As she later wrote, quote, "After finishing the Imperial Ballet School, I spent 3 years on the Imperial stage and left it not having seen any genuine art there," end quote. It was as a member of Serge Diaghilev's Ballet Russe that she was awakened as an artist. She became an ardent follower of Michel Fokine's New Ballet, as it was called, New Ballet, and originated her first important roles in his works, including The Butterfly in Carnival, The Bacchante in Narcisse, and A Street Dancer in Petrushka. And, here she, on the left, on the extreme left of the left-hand photo, you see her in her first role as this street as the street dancer in Petrushka. And in the on the right, you see another favorite role of hers, the chief Polovtsian girl in the Polovtsian dances from Prince Igor. After so many years of conventional ballet training, Fokine's freer style did not come easily to her. And I think this image really does capture some of the freedom that Fokine's style implied for the, called for from the dancers. This is one of the images which we saw upstairs from Narcisse. It's by Leon Bakst. Nijinska struggled to achieve corporeal expressiveness. Fokine's freer style did not come easily to her. She struggled, but eventually developed into a highly original performer. She would go on to dance the leads in several Fokine ballets, including Petrushka and the Polovtsian dances, as we saw, both of which she later staged. These early Fokine roles remained close to her heart, and she performed them for years, giving them a distinct personal inflection. Late in 1910, as Diaghilev made plans to convert his original summer touring company into a permanent ensemble headquartered in Western Europe, Vaclav Nijinsky took his first steps as a choreographer. The idea for Afternoon of a Faun originated with Diaghilev and the designer Leon Bakst. And here on the right, you see Bakst's rather celebrated painting of Diaghilev as a young man. You see the little white streak in his hair and his nanny in the back. And Bakst himself drew in his self-portrait on the left. And these are some of Bakst's designs. Again, for those of you who've been to the exhibition, some of these will be familiar to you, his designs for Afternoon of a Faun. However, it was on his sister that Nijinsky worked out what he called the filigree of his choreography and the details of what she called his new technique, the movement experiences, the movement experiments that culminated in the slow, angular, frieze-like choreography. Nijinska described the process in Diary of a Young Dancer, an unpublished reminiscence penned in the late 1930s and later incorporated into early memoirs. As she wrote, "Maybe our work together is made more difficult because we are brother and sister, making us impatient with each other. Besides, Vaclav is, as always, unduly demanding with me." He was obviously an older brother. "But how much I am learning from him." She served as the clay of Nijinsky's imagination again in 1913, both for Je and for The Rite of Spring. This is Maria Pilz as the chosen maiden, the role that Nijinska was supposed to play. In these landmark works, Nijinsky crossed the threshold of ballet modernism, and Nijinska was right there with him, even though others ultimately danced her parts. This choreographic apprenticeship taught Nijinska many things. She learned how hard it was to invent movement from scratch and make the body articulate in unfamiliar ways. She learned how each ballet required a different movement style or technique, as she called it, and that this was built upon detail, exactness of execution, and a very different kind of training from the one she had received at the Imperial Theater School. She learned, too, that movement was distinct from steps, that it could be parsed and its elements recombined in ways unimaginable under ballet's academic rules. Finally, she realized that making ballets was something that she not only could do, but also wanted to do. Though still young, she later told the journalist and translator Mark Semenoff, I felt myself capable of composing a ballet. Unfortunately, I was only a woman, end quote. With the full passion of his mentorship focused on her brother Vaslav, Diaghilev declined to back her experiments. Nijinska returned to St. Petersburg to give birth to her daughter, Irina. Meanwhile, her brother headed with the Ballet Russe to South America, where in Buenos Aires he married a young Hungarian woman, Romola Dupulski. Diaghilev, furious, banished his erstwhile lover from the company. Ever loyal, Nijinska now resigned from the Ballet Russe, and with her husband, the former Bolshoi dancer, Alexander Kochetovsky, helped Nijinsky organize a season at London's Palace Theater. She did pretty much everything for that 1914 season, recruit dancers, give company class, rehearse the ensembles, whose discipline was favorably commented upon in the press, and serve as her brother's ballerina, all excellent preparation for the future. When the season ended, Nijinska hastened back to St. Petersburg, where her mother was taking care of her daughter. World War I broke out a few months later. Nijinska spent the next 7 years in Russia and the Ukraine, although she never called the Ukraine, but always Russia. Separated from her brother, caught up in the revolution that began in 1917, she became an Amazon of the choreographic avant-garde. She created her first concert pieces in Petrograd, as St. Petersburg was renamed after the declaration of war, where she and Kochetovsky spent the 1914-15 season dancing and staging opera divertissements at Narodny Dom. That was the theater, this kind of gigantic theater that was called the People's House. The following year, the couple moved to Kiev, where Nijinska became première danseuse, the first dancer, and Kochetovsky ballet master of the city theater. Although opera dominated the programming, the couple staged several ballets, including versions of Petrushka, Carnival, and the Polovtsian dances, and this is Nijinska in the Polovtsian dances from this point, Kiev's first glimpse of Fokine's new ballet. The revolution caught up with Nijinska in Moscow. Separated from her husband, she went from embassy to embassy, seeking visas to join her brother abroad. Her efforts came to naught, and she spent most of 1918 in the new Bolshevik capital. Here she met the avant-garde painter and stage designer Alexandra Exter. And the composition on the left is one of her abstract compositions, and the one on the right is one of her stage designs for the Alexander Taïrov's production of Salome for the Kamerny Theater. In Moscow, Nijinska began to draft her first treatise, The School and Theater of Movement. The manuscript, never published, reveals her profound disillusionment with ballet of the late imperial period, her vision of a new abstract art, and her goal of creating what she called, quote, intelligent, committed artists, rather than, quote, professional dancers. To educate, and this word educate is something she uses again and again, the dancer's creativity, another favorite work, she proposed a long list of subjects for them to study, from classical dance to free movement, and she actually uses the phrase free movement, music theory, discussion, although she never says what the discussions are about, painting, drawing, and even notation. In October 1918, Nijinska returned to Kiev. By then, she'd been reunited with her husband. 3 months later, just before the city fell to the Bolsheviks, and about 2 weeks after she gave birth to her second child, she opened the School of Movement. And this is the little piece of paper in the Nijinska archives at the Library of Congress where she makes her notes, where she drafted her announcement for the School of Movement. Both a studio and a school, it became the center of Nijinska's artistic explorations until she emigrated in 1921. And this is one of her sketches. She did a great deal of sketching during this period. This is for a ballet called Demons, which she did in 1920. And these are just a few of the many choreographic diagrams that you find, again, in her collection at the Library of Congress. In Kiev, Nijinska created her first modern solos and her first abstract works, envisioning the ensemble as an orchestra and the dancers as the various instruments. Here, too, she trained and rehearsed her first company and developed a distinctive approach to teaching. She worked with the avant-garde theater director, Les Kurbas, sometimes called the Ukrainian Meyerhold, collaborated with the avant-garde painter Vadim Meller, taught at the theater studio of the Yiddish Culture League, and served on the Arts Soviet of the proletarian Centro Studio, where Serge Lifar, the future director of the Paris Opera Ballet, took his first ballet classes. The solos that Nijinska began to choreograph for herself in 1919 were highly stylized and semi-abstract. In her diary, she seldom refers to them by title, but generically as eskizi, sketches, or studies, sometimes identifying them by the composer of the music. Like Isadora Duncan and a generation of female recitalists, Nijinska used the solo to find her individual voice as an artist, to give form to her creative strivings, and to tap into her subjectivity. The process was both scary and exhilarating. Quote, "I danced several new sketches to please my students," she wrote in her diary on December 27, 1919, which happened to be her birthday. "Obviously, I'm very excited about how these first compositions are being received." Little remains of that period, apart from Meller's large, striking images of her that hung on the walls of her studio. One of the most spectacular designs depicts a figure with the bellicose gesture and weight of a samurai. Called Fear, the work depicts her body as an interplay of angles and curves, sculptural in its volume, with an oval for her head, platform clogs for feet, and triangles shooting out from her center. The emphasis is on movement. A foot lifted in the middle of a heavy stamping motion, an arm extended straight from the shoulder like a sword. The colors are deep, and the surrounding blackness creates a feeling of menace. Other images are lighter. In Mephisto Waltz, she stands in semi-profile with her face looking left and her body facing right, a stance that creates both a twist in the upper body and a bas-relief effect. This effect, evident in Nijinska's oldest extant ballet, Les Noces, recalls the two-dimensionality of her brother's Afternoon of a Faun, just as the weighted movement in Fear invokes the primitivism of his Rite of Spring. Meller's images make clear that during the years in Kiev, Nijinska changed not only what she danced, but also how she danced, abandoning whatever traditional ballerina aspirations she may have once harbored. In 1921, the School of Movement was closed, and Nijinska joined thousands of Russians in emigration. She went to Vienna, where her brother, now mentally ill, was hospitalized, and then she rejoined the Ballet Russe. Diaghilev welcomed her back, both as a dancer and as a choreographer. although to her disappointment, he refused to stage any of her Kiev works. Instead, he used her, as he had once used her brother, to transform the company's repertory by exploring new facets of modernism and by producing early examples of neoclassicism. During the next 4 years, Nijinska created more than a half dozen ballets and contributed dances to more than a dozen operas and occasional works. Many of these involve collaborations with the composers of the modernist group known as Les Six, or the Six, such as Francis Poulenc and Darius Milhaud. And you see five of the six, all six aren't there, with Jean Cocteau sitting in the front with his, he was kind of the grand godparent of the group. You see him in the middle there with his legs crossed. She also was involved with collaborations with Natalia Goncharova, Juan Gris, Georges Braque, and Marie Laurencin, who came from the elite ranks of international modernism. For those of you who may know Marie Laurencin's work, this is absolutely identifiable. Nijinska choreographed two ballets to scores by Igor Stravinsky, seen here, the biting satire Le Renard, or The Fox, in 1922, and her masterwork, Les Noces, a peasant wedding that brought to the Western stage the abstract architectural forms and impersonal human masses of post-revolutionary constructivism, leading some critics to denounce the work as Bolshevik. Again, I've made a little composite here for you, but these images were taken on the roof of the Monte Carlo house. These are not actual performance photographs. However, I think it's interesting that the rehearsal costumes that they're wearing lend themselves, are not all that different from what they would actually wear, what they actually wore as costumes, as we'll see at the end when we look at some of the footage. Yet Les Noces was also the company's first new ballet since Fokine's Les Sylphides in 1909, in which all the women danced on point, and in this sense, a key work in the emergence of ballet neoclassicism. This is The Bride from Les Noces, a role that was originated by Félia Dubrovska, who later taught for many, many years at the School of American Ballet in New York. This was also true of Les Biches, known as the House Party in English, a ballet of sexual innuendo set among the era's bright young things, gigolos who performed double tours, and flappers who danced on point, one of them you see on the left, while Nijinska, on the right, as the hostess, wore loops of Chanel pearls and toyed with a cigarette holder. She was she became a chain smoker, and she always used a cigarette lighter. So in a way, this character was built around her own character. In addition, in 1921, in collaboration with Diaghilev, Stravinsky, and the designer Leon Bakst, she shaped the first modern production of Marius Petipa's 1890s masterwork, The Sleeping Beauty. Although artistic collaboration did not come easily to Nijinska, Les Noces stands as a striking synthesis of dance, music, and design. Stravinsky's score was 10 years in the making and had morphed with his developing neoclassicism into a composition as spare as it was powerful. Natalia Goncharova reconceived the designs not once, but twice, ultimately arriving at a third equally stark solution. As you can see, the third is very stark. However, it was Nijinska's vision that dominated the ballet. Les Noces, she declared, was the first work where the libretto was a hidden theme for a pure choreography. It was a choreographic concerto. For all its astringency, Les Noces bled with emotion. The ballet struck a personal chord in Nijinska, evident in a reminiscence written decades after the ballet's premiere. Quote, I saw a dramatic quality in the fate of the bride and groom, since there is no question of, and this was underlined, mutuality of feelings. The young girl knows nothing about her future family, nor what lies in store for her. The soul of the innocent is in disarray. She is bidding goodbye to her carefree youth and to her loving mother. For his part, the young groom cannot imagine what life will be close to this young girl. How can such souls rejoice during their wedding ceremonies? Nijinska was the first in a line of 20th century women choreographers in ballet, touched by the liberating force of modern dance and by the creative possibilities opened by modernism. Even if these women remained loyal to classical technique, they inflected their ballets with a personal sensibility, a woman's sensibility, absent from the works of the unnamed, uncredited 19th century women who had contributed choreography to so many ballets. Although not explicitly feminist, Nijinska's works created a space for female voices to be heard, for expressions of female subjectivity to take form as in male as well as female bodies. Although respected by Diaghilev, who was something of a surrogate father to her, he actually gave her away at both her weddings, Nijinska never became an intimate of his circle. Here you see her teaching class. She is on the far left. She's correcting Alice Nikitina, and the fellow with the bandana around his head is Anton Dolin. This was taken in London in 1924. Speaking of being an intimate of his circle, they did have certain intimate moments. One time, Diaghilev met Nijinska walking with her little son, Lev, who must have been about 4 or 5. And Diaghilev bends down to him and says, "Do you know who I am?" And this 4 or 5-year-old looks up and says, "Oh, yes, you're the big, fat Diaghilev." And Diaghilev then says to Nijinska, "Bronya, am I fat?" So they obviously did share a certain intimacy, and as Lydia Sokolova wrote in her alias, Hilda Munnings wrote in her memoir, Diaghilev could make two people always cry, herself, that is Lydia Sokolova, and Nijinska. But as I say, his professional circle, she was really not an intimate of it. To be sure, the painter Juan Gris spoke highly of her. Quote, "Except for Nijinska, who takes her work seriously, and Diaghilev, who knows his job, nobody uses his brains or foresees anything," he wrote to his dealer, Daniel Henri Kahnweiler. Now, do you remember the scandal with Strauss-Kahn a couple of years ago? The hotel scandal? Kahnweiler is his wife's grandfather, and that was the source of his great wealth. Anyway, you know, the Diaghilev. If you start looking at the Diaghilev world, it connects with everything. The composer Francis Poulenc was also impressed with Nijinska. "Nijinska's really a genius," he wrote to Diaghilev after seeing Les Biches in rehearsal. "She has made the sofa a star." Now, I don't know if any of you have ever seen Les Biches, but it has this blue sofa in it, and it has a whole choreography for it, and people hide behind it, they manipulate it, they sit on it, they stand on it, etc. So he was the first to see this happening in the studio. However, misogyny was also pervasive in Diaghilev's circle. Jean Cocteau, a key member, spoke grudgingly of Nijinska's accomplishments, usually ascribing them to accident or to other people, including her brother. And this is a drawing of her that he did, certainly not the most flattering. Thus, in an essay about Les Biches, which had music by Poulenc and designs, as we've seen, by Marie Laurencin, Cocteau wrote, quote, "Madame Nijinska lives shut up in her work. She never stops." Of course, this is a woman with 2 kids, but anyway, she did have some home life. "Scarcely does she pause to do her hair or fasten her dress." In other words, she's not chic. By dint of jumping and pirouetting and working her muscles, she ceases to be a worker and becomes a tool. Looking at her sturdy legs, one admires her as one would a pickaxe or a carpenter's plane. But her brother's blood runs in her veins, a blood that has wings. She does not try to discover what there is at the back of Poulenc or Laurent Saint. She is guided by intuition. Without the slightest calculation, and by simply obeying the rhythm and the exigencies of the frame she has to fill, she is about to create a masterpiece. End quote. It would be hard to imagine a more unfair or inaccurate assessment of Nijinska's choreographic practice, as you saw from all those diagrams. And this is a woman who certainly thought in great detail about what she was about to do in the studio. However difficult, Nijinska's three-year stint with the Ballet Russe earned her a place in ballet's great tradition of choreography. It transformed the avant-garde dancemaker of Kiev into a dance-making professional, somewhat ironically given what she says about professionals in that very first treatise she wrote. A professional able to cope with virtually any assignment while preserving the integrity of her personal voice. She learned how to become the family breadwinner, to provide for her two children, her mother, who was often their principal caregiver, and after 1924, her second husband, Nicholas Singayevsky, a former student from Kiev. Thanks to Diaghilev, she had become a choreographer of the West. In 1925, Nijinska left the Ballet Russe and embarked on a career as a freelance choreographer. Over the next 45 years, she worked with numerous companies, creating new works and reviving older ones, in addition to staging productions of 19th century works, her brother's Afternoon of a Faun, and several Fokine ballets. She formed two short-lived companies, Théâtre Choreographique Nijinska, as you see here. This was in 1925, in which she worked with her own friend Alexandra Exter, and in the room on the right, in that photograph, you can see that Nijinska has actually put up one of Exter's images. This is another one of her images for a ballet called Touring. The one on the left is, and on the right, these are other images of designs for costumes by Exter for this Théâtre Choreographique. In the 1930s, she formed still another company called the Théâtre de la Danse Nijinska. And for these companies, she choreographed some of her most personal works, including Holy Etudes, two excerpts from Bach's Brandenburg Concertos, Les Comédiens Jaloux, which was The Jealous Comedians, and Hamlet, both in the 1930s. If Holy Etudes was one of the very first dance works to use the music of Bach, Les Comédiens Jaloux and Hamlet provided her with the last of many male roles she conceived for herself. Beginning in 1926, moreover, she spent several seasons at the Teatro Colón in Buenos Aires. Here she contributed decisively to the professionalization of the very young ballet company and the modernization of its repertory. And here, some of these dances really don't look like they're much more than 13 and a half. And there's Nijinska in the middle. One almost feels that this is a replay to some extent of the kind of intimacy she enjoyed with the dancers of her first studio in Kiev. In 1926, she staged Les Noces at the Colón only weeks after it had premiered in London. It was followed by another Diaghilev success, Le Train Bleu, which you saw upstairs. There was the clip from it and the wonderful Picasso decor. Of course, they didn't have the Picasso drop curtain. They didn't have that in Buenos Aires. But she staged that. And that year, in 1926 and in 1927, she also choreographed several new ballets. including the world premiere of Constant Lambert's Pomona, and Sergei Prokofiev's Alla and Lolly, as well as revivals of Fokine's Petrushka and Les Sylphides and her brother's Faun. In 2 years, then, she had given the Teatro Colón a modernist makeover. In 1928, Nijinska was engaged by Ida Rubinstein to form a ballet troupe and create a repertory of original works. Immensely wealthy, Rubinstein had originated the role of Zobeide in the Ballet Russe production of Scheherazade, and in the exhibition there's quite a few costumes from the original Scheherazade. And then she had embarked on a career as an independent producer of theatrical spectacles, for which she commissioned high-profile collaborators, and in which she always starred. For Rubinstein, Nijinska choreographed Le Baiser de la Fée to a new score by Stravinsky, and Bolero and La Valse to new scores by Ravel. The Bolero was actually commissioned by Rubinstein. La Valse existed before, but it had never actually been choreographed. Although Nijinska's versions did not outlive the 1930s, the works themselves and some of their ideas, such as the table on which Rubinstein danced in Bolero, entered the modern ballet repertory, while her choreography for La Bien-Aimée, or The Beloved, to Liszt, anticipated ballets of the 1930s to the theme of the artist and his muse. The company that Nijinska assembled included dancers who had followed her from Kiev, defectors from the Ballet Russe, and youngsters, many from Russian emigre backgrounds, who went on to dance with the post-Diaghilev Ballet Russe companies, as well as two future choreographers, David Lichtenstein, then David Lichtenstein, and Frederick Ashton. And in this photo, also taken on a theater roof, there is Nijinska, and to her left, the person with the fellow looking down with the very knobbly knees, that's a very young Frederick Ashton. For Ashton, who later staged his own versions of Baiser and La Valse, Nijinska was a formative influence on his developing choreographic ideas. Like the other companies of youngsters she touched with her genius, the Rubinstein Company was transformed by Nijinska into both a professional ensemble and a creative instrument. Although Nijinska worked intermittently with her own company during the 1930s, she was unable to sustain it on a permanent basis. Throughout the decade, she continued to freelance, using this as an opportunity to create new works and keep important old ones in repertory. Generally speaking, this is what choreographers always did when they didn't really have a stable company with which to work. That's sort of the first 15 years of Balanchine's career in the United States. He did very much the same thing. Thus, Nijinska's revival of Les Biches for the Mark of a Dolin Ballet and Les Noces for the de Basile Company in 1936 in New York. And this is a caricature by Alex Gard of Nijinska rehearsing Les Noces for the de Basile Company. You see her there with the cigarette holder. There is a much, in the Herald Tribune, they actually published a much fuller version of this, where you actually see the dancers in practice clothes, and you actually recognize some of the formations from Les Noces. However, I have yet to find a real copy of it, of the paper, and the one on microfilm is just not good enough to display here, but it's fun. For the de Basile Company as well, she choreographed Les Cent Baisers, or 100 Kisses. That's for Irina Baranova, and it's either Paul Petrov or David Lichtenstein, I'm not sure. And then for the Polish Ballet, which she was invited to direct in the late 1930s, she choreographed Chopin Concerto, one of the many plotless ballets she created during the 1930s. Nijinska first came to the United States in 1935 when she choreographed the dances in Max Reinhardt's film, A Midsummer Night's Dream. That's the one with Mickey Rooney and all kinds of other Hollywood stars. She returned to Hollywood in 1939 at the outset of World War II. Settling in California, she began to work with a group of talented youngsters, including Betty Marie, later Maria Tallchief, the future star of the New York City Ballet, her sister Marjorie Louise Tallchief, I love those middle names, who was the first American-born étoile of the Paris Opera, and Syd, S-Y-D, later C-Y-D, Charisse, of Hollywood fame. And for them, as well as any number of other young dancers, she mounted a program of her works at the Hollywood Bowl. She opened a West Coast studio, but traveled frequently to New York, where she staged La Fille Malgardée for American Ballet Theatre's maiden season, and contributed works to Sergei Denham's Ballet Russe de Monte Carlo. And one of them was pictures at an exhibition to Mussorgsky. The designs here were by Boris Aronson, who later did Fiddler on the Roof and many other Broadway works. But interestingly, he, like Meller, was a student in Ekster's studio in Kiev back in those days when Nijinska was there. However, the company with which Nijinska formed a long-term attachment was Ballet International, founded in New York in 1944 by the Marquis de Cuevas, who then later relocated it to Monte Carlo and Paris. He had married a Rockefeller whose money funded his ballet passion. In the Franco-Russian-American milieu of the Grand Marquis of the Grand Ballet du Marquis de Cuevas, Nijinska, who had never learned to speak English fluently, felt at home. She choreographed several works for his company, revived Les Biches and Petrushka, and staged an ill-fated production of The Sleeping Beauty for 1960 that prompted her to resign from the company because of what she called artistic differences with the Marquis. She found the costumes exaggerated and outré, which I think these examples might suggest she wasn't off the wall. Shortly after this production, the Marquis died, and with his death in 1961, the company collapsed. Actually, one could say that the history of Nijinska's life is of companies that just collapsed. By the early 1960s, Nijinska, now in her 70s, was living and teaching in California. Her ballets had all but disappeared from repertory, although Ninette de Valois had expressed interest in reviving Les Biches as early as 1954. It was not until 1964 that the Royal Ballet, now directed by Frederick Ashton, actually did so. This revival, and this is Nijinska actually in the studio, this revival of Les Biches and the revival of Les Noces that followed in 1966 were crucial in the survival of these ballets in the performance repertory and to the solidifying of Nijinska's reputation as a major modernist artist. And her legacy was indeed precarious. Not only had she lived and chiefly worked outside the dance capitals of London and New York, but nearly all the companies for which she had choreographed had disappeared, making orphans of her repertory. The Royal kept Les Noces and Les Biches in good repair, performing them frequently. In fact, I saw Les Noces a year ago, June, when I was in London, and it was done very, very well. Arranging for them to be professionally notated, and in the case of Les Noces, professionally filmed, and that's what we'll see a little bit of. Revivals of these works after Nijinska's death in 1972 are indebted to the company's recuperative efforts. And and I'm now going to give a little plug to notation. Both those ballets were notated in Benesh, recorded in Benesh notation, and then later, when others tried to revive the works after Nijinska died, the notation became absolutely essential to getting those works up on stage. Nijinska was not only a dancer and a choreographer, but also a writer. She kept extensive journals, diaries, and choreographic notes, and wrote two autobiographical manuscripts. Of course, she only wrote in Russian. However, with the exception of a 1937 article in the Dancing Times, and in 1930, a short treatise in the German language dance journal Schrifttanz, none of this was published during her lifetime. In 1981, 9 years after her death, early memoirs appeared, edited by her daughter Irina Nijinska and Jean Rawlinson. However, this book was quite different from the volume Nijinska had outlined in the mid-1930s. Instead of focusing on her own career, it centered on her brother's and ended with World War I before Nijinska's emergence as a choreographer. Nevertheless, Early Memoirs was widely hailed. Actually, it was the first article. My review of that book was the first article I ever published in the Dancing Times. And Nijinska became, in retrospect, something of a feminist icon. A major exhibition, Bronislava Nijinska, A Dancer's Legacy, curated by Nancy Van Norman Baer, followed at the San Francisco Fine Arts Museums, and revealed for the first time Nijinska's collaboration with Alexandra Exter and the full dimensions of her career. You have to understand, no one knew that she had worked with Exter. Exter was very celebrated as a painter, but no one knew about these collaborations. No one knew about the Mellers, nothing. All of this stuff had been in the attic in Pacific Palisades. Meanwhile, thanks to Irina Nijinska's efforts, Les Noches and Les Biches entered the repertory of many companies. The recovery of Nijinska's work, beginning in the 1960s, has secured her reputation as a major modernist artist. Her most important Diaghilev ballets have returned to the stage, and her memoir complicates the narrative of her brother's career. Her vast collection, which includes her unpublished writings, press cuttings documenting her career from the 1920s until her death, programs, memorabilia, correspondence, and designs, is now housed at the Library of Congress. She left a deep mark on several generations of dancers. Both Ninette de Valois and Frederick Ashton have acknowledged their debt to her, as have her younger American students, Allegra Kent and Maria Tolchief. This is a photograph of Nijinska taken maybe a couple of years before her death. She is working with the dancers of the Niagara Frontier Ballet in Buffalo, the last company of very young dancers that she would work with, and of course after, as soon as they, you know, a couple of years later, all the repertory had disappeared. The dissemination of Nijinska's 1920s works in performance and the documentation of lost works in the San Francisco exhibition challenged, moreover, the widespread belief that George Balanchine was the sole progenitor of ballet neoclassicism, rather than one of several choreographers developing a new classical vocabulary that made minimal use of narrative. This is true above all during what seems to me the crucial decade, which is the 1930s. Finally, Nijinska was the pioneer of a modern tradition of ballet choreography for women. Modernism privileged the individual creative voice, and although it was not specifically intended for women artists, it offered them an opportunity not only to practice their art, but also to tell their own stories. This opportunity Nijinska seized, but doing a man's job had its costs. She could be ruthless, a taskmaster who drove her dancers mercilessly. Nothing came easy to her. Again and again, she had to prove herself, and the carapace she developed was partly a response to the misogyny she encountered in the upper echelons of the ballet world. I am sometimes amazed at the books where every Diaghilev choreographer is represented, except Nijinska. I mean, for instance, in Arnold Haskell's Balletomania, or for instance, in some other books, they keep talking about her peculiar face. Can you imagine people talking about the peculiar faces of male choreographers? What about Balanchine's peculiar twitch or Massine's peculiar calves or something? You know, no one but Nijinska they do that with. Fiercely independent and deeply Russian, she lived most of her professional life in the Russian emigre world, working for companies including her own that vanished, leaving the repertory, as I've said, in limbo. Although her career was far longer and more productive than her brother's, in the popular mind, she remains Nijinsky's sister, as though the accident of birth were more important than a lifetime of choreographic achievement. So now let us, I'll tell you what I'm going to show you. I'm going to show the last 5 minutes of Les Noces. Les Noces was her 1923 masterpiece, in my view, certainly the most important ballet of the 1920s. It was to a score by Stravinsky. This version was produced by the BBC in 1978. It included many dancers with whom Nijinska... Oh, here we are. Well, here... can we just hold her for a moment? It included many dancers whom Nijinska herself had worked with in 1966 when she first set it. The score was conducted by Leonard Bernstein. It was sung in Russian, which is not always the case. The score... Stravinsky scored the ballet for four pianos, at least about a dozen timpani, a full chorus, and soloists, and then of course there was the ballet. So I think we'll start now. The last 5 minutes. This is from the Wedding Feast, the last tableau from Les Noces. Yes. Okay. Now we'll see it. You see the uniform costumes, kind of an abstraction of peasant wear. That's Anthony Dowell in front, leading the male group. Also, the kind of stylization and abstraction of the folk, of the character dance vocabulary. The bride and groom are in the middle. They are, in a sense, non-characters. At that point, the soloist had said, "Raise your voices." Notice the geometric forms, formations. The heaviness of the jumps. This is not a happy wedding scene. Stravinsky had imagined that Vera Sudeikina, his mistress, would be playing the role of the bride, and Nijinska said no. And the end of his lyrics are about love, and but of course Nijinska's ballet is not about love. Thank you. And of course, from the theater, one barely sees this. Film, in a sense, can create a close-up of the couple. The couple almost vanish. And this first architect, this first structure is something that reappears now. It had first appeared in the first tableau, The Women, called The Consecration of the Bride. And that is building this incredible edifice with the notion that this will then repeat itself. So, does anyone have any questions? Yes, in the back there.
The BBC refilmed it, and I saw a 2000 version.
Mm-hmm.
And my question is, where is the wedding? Was the photography so poor that the actual ceremony is not, you know, failed to get within camera range, or is there some libretto editing that occurred after 1966? I didn't see an actual marriage take place. I saw the two consecrations and the departure of the bride, and the fourth section was the, you know, just one. But no actual wedding. And yet I have a description, I've read a description actually by Balanchine himself of a church and a ceremony.
Well, it doesn't.
It doesn't?
No.
Stravinsky?
He's
qualified, that's clear. As long as nobody at the company is deciding that it's too religious.
Oh, no. It wasn't that. There is the wedding feast, the door is closed, but there's no actual religious ceremony. You're absolutely right. Yes. Yes.
You talked about the period in Kiev.
Uh-huh.
What was the relationship with the Bolshevik Revolution?
Well, it's very interesting. You know, when she got to the West, she didn't say anything about it. She barely mentioned anything she had done in Kiev. Very, very few interviews mentioned anything to do with Kiev. But it's also clear from some material that I've gathered from Russian sources that she was clearly part of this emerging Bolshevik arts network. Remember that the Bolsheviks, in the period right after the revolution, supported new art. They were not supporting one of the great debates in Moscow and Petrograd was, what do we do with these former imperial theaters? Do we nationalize them? Do we get rid of them? And Nijinska at this point was very much felt empowered by this new openness. And in fact, there's some very interesting letters from Meller to her after she emigrates. And because there's actually quite a number of letters at the Library of Congress from her former students and friends in Kiev that were written between about 1922 and 25. And Meller says, remember that, you know, that almost that wonderful excitement that we experienced. Maybe we were naive, but we were right to search for this. And we were on the right track, not as the West was, or as is happening now, meaning during the NEP period, the new economic policy period. So she was certainly part of it. I mean, one of the although it's clear from her diary, one of her diaries from that period does survive, that at a certain point, she does begin to feel a little bit paranoid. Exactly why is unclear. But what is clear from this, and also from the letters from her former students, is that she left for reasons that did not really have to do with her brother. which is essentially what's always reiterated, that she heard her brother had had fallen mentally ill, and therefore she left to join him. And she spent a year more in Kiev after the letter arrived from her sister-in-law. And it was only after it appears that the School of Movement, her studio, was closed for reasons that are still not clear to me, that she left. No. She was part of the emigre world. And I have to say there were in France, for instance, most of the emigres, although we hear about the Grand Dukes, the ex-Grand Dukes and the ex-aristocrats, in fact, the vast majority were working in places like car manufacturers in the red belts around Paris. And they actually formed separate unions because they were, you know, with their worker solidarity, but they could not deal with with the Soviet Union. So they had their own unions, which were anti-Soviet but pro-worker, if you know what I mean. She was part of this emigre world. However, she was looked askance when she first came because she was not part of that first wave, which had left in 1919. She apparently did not go around saying how awful it was that the Tsar had been killed. And she was also clearly involved in this new work, in this avant-garde. And the avant-garde was linked to the Soviets. So many people, some of the reviews of Les Noces by André Levinson are absolutely scurrilous, accusing her, this is from 1923, practically accusing her, accusing her of being a Bolshevik and of all kinds of things. And he reiterates that, well into the late 1920s, although by then he says, I don't mean politically. He modifies it. Any other questions? Yes. Interesting question. I think, and in some of her unpublished writings, she seems to suggest that Diaghilev always, everything had to be his. Now, it's very easy to say the Ballet Russe is about the artists and the this and the that one and the this, but it's also very much about Sergei Pavlovich Diaghilev. And it was he who, in a sense, planned the menu of so many of these productions. She once said that Les Noces was probably the one production that a choreographer actually controlled from beginning to end. And that was highly unusual. But with he was producing, to use a contemporary word, a brand. And what she did in Kiev was not his brand. It was something else. And he wanted to make it seem as though he was the one who had discovered her, that he had formed her, that he was presenting her to the West. And if she came up with a repertory that she had already choreographed, that wouldn't be the same thing. So I think this was, he never, except perhaps for one tiny little thing that was done on a concert program, he never reproduced any of Balanchine's Russian ballets that he had done in the Soviet Union. Once again, nothing. Balanchine was to be his discovery. Yes?
How long did you say she stayed in Minsk? How long was her family in Minsk after she was born? And what sort of effect, if any, did you see of her Polish heritage?
Well, first of all, she didn't spend that much time in Minsk. Her family, and this is a wonderful part of early memoirs, is describing this childhood. Her parents had been trained at the Wielki Theater in Poland. This was the grand theater, like the Bolshoi Theater in Poland. And Then they received contracts and from these groups and basically spent their most of their professional career performing at theaters in Kiev, in Saratov, Minsk, and Odessa. In other words, in theaters, opera theaters, where they had, where the ballet troupe was to support. They had a small ballet troupe to support operas, maybe doing a little ballet thing independently, throughout southern and western Russia. So in effect, they were itinerants. They would spend a winter season somewhere else, then get a job at a summer theater somewhere else, and this would kind of go on. And then eventually, and I assume this is because of Mama, Eleonora, she wanted her children to enter the ballet schools in at the Imperial Ballet School in St. Petersburg. And so at that point, the family moves to St. Petersburg. It promptly falls apart because her husband was still touring, and he falls in love, of course, with his leading woman, and that's sort of the end of the family. And but Vaslav first and then Bronislava secondly did enter then the Imperial Ballet School because she was desperate for the kids to have a career that was not wandering from place to place, where they would have a guaranteed salary, they would have a pension, they would be self-supporting, and this would be a very prominent company. So when Nijinska actually went back with her husband to dance in Kiev, her mother just couldn't understand it. Back to the provincial stage, you know, because she and her husband had danced on that same stage, not once, but several times in the course of that that touring company. So I think this was important, but it should, one should emphasize that Kiev was a very important place. It was the third city of Russia, of the Russian Empire, I should say, not of Russia, but the Russian Empire, before 1917. It was also a very international city. It had a very substantial Polish population. It had a very substantial Jewish population. And it had an Ukrainian population and a Russian population. In fact, it's a far more Ukrainian city today, thanks to Soviet nationalities policies, than it was back in 1910. I would say that for this, it's very funny you should mention the, you should ask about the Polish thing. I just received from a Polish translator, I had a series of letters that Nijinska had written to her mother during the her second season at the Teatro Colón. It was a whole group of letters. She wrote to her mother once a week, and she wrote to her in Polish. Everything else I found by her was written in Russian, but these were in Polish. So I wrote to someone. I found someone who is in Poznan, and he and his translation class translated these letters. The first thing I get back to that I hear is, this is I showed this to one of my linguistics colleagues. We couldn't believe the Polish. Who is this person writing this? So clearly, the grammar, everything was, there were many Russian words, there were Russian structures in it. What she was doing was writing as she spoke to her mother, her mother's old friends, and her sisters. So in a certain sense, Polish was the mother tongue. It was a tongue, it was the language of this intimacy with her mother and with her mother's family, because those are the ones they were close to. The father took off. But her, one might say, the intellectual life, what she read, I mean, she read Polish, but what she read on a day-to-day basis, the culture that she identified with, the culture she was educated in, the language she was educated in, it was all Russian. So I think there's, so it's really hard to say. She never really, she never denies that she was Polish, but she always insists that culturally, you know, that she was Russian culturally. Any other questions? Yes.
Can you expand a bit more on your sources?
Mm-hmm.
You mentioned something treasured from the Palestinian, right?
Yes, that's all now at the Library of Congress. It's all her personal collection, everything she kept from 1920 on. The little drawings are hers. There are the two Vadim Mellers that I showed. Those are there, as well as the Exter images from the 1925 tour. Those are there. The earlier Exters aren't, but those from the 1925 tour are hers, and they're at the Library of Congress. I believe that they're actually scanning them, so that they'll be more available. Oh, she lived in Pacific Palisades. She bought a house there in California. She settled in California in 1939. And she lived in various places, but ultimately, probably in the early 1950s, she bought a small house in Pacific Palisades, which overlooked one of the canyons and the Pacific Ocean. And that's where she kept everything. All her scores, costumes, the images that I explained, her notebooks, her correspondence, her drafts, programs, everything was kept there. Mm-hmm. I would say that people have looked at some of the scores that she the choreographic notes for other works where she kept rather careful choreographic notes, sometimes explaining what she intended to do, etc. But by and large, it's not quite enough information to bring back. Choreography, unless one has actually experienced the choreography. This is not to say that one can't look at diagrams like that and, you know, create something, but that's not necessary. But one doesn't really know exactly what she may or may not have done, or even what those notations, the ones I actually showed, what they actually were for, because they don't actually say. Another question? Oh, okay.
This has been a National Gallery of Art podcast.